Three Lives by Tuesday Lobsang Rampa, read for you by Blue Friend in beautiful BC. Chapter 4. Gertie Glubenheimer gazed gloomily around the large room. Bodies everywhere, she thought. Bodies to the left of me, bodies to the right of me, bodies in front of me, and bodies behind. What a sick, sick lot they look. She straightened up and looked at the clock at the far end of the room. 12:30, she said to herself. Lunchtime. So she fished out her lunch pail from beneath the table on which she was working, and, turning, she spread a book and her sandwiches on top of the body beside her. Gertie was an embalmer. She did up bodies in the funeral home so they could be gazed at in the display rooms by admiring relatives. Oh, gee, don't that look like him? Don't Uncle Nick look good at last, eh? People would say. Gertie was very familiar with dead bodies, so much so that she did not even bother to wash her hands before touching her food after messing about with these bodies. A voice broke in. Who was the stupid idiot who left that autopsy case without filling up the chest cavity? The little man at the end of the room near the door was almost dancing with rage. Why, boss, what's happened? Asked one man incautiously. What happened? I'll tell you what happened. The guy's wife leaned over him to give him a fond kiss of farewell, and there was only a piece of newspaper under the sheet, and her elbow went right through his chest cavity. Now she's having hysterics, fit to bust. She's threatening to sue us to our back teeth. There was a subdued chuckle around the room because things like that were always happening, and no one took such cases too seriously. When it got down to brass tacks, the relatives would not like it to be known that they had got their elbows inside their dearest, just preparatory to interment. The boss looked up and came trotting towards Gertie. Get your lunch pail off his face, he roared. You just bent his nose, we'll never be able to do him up. Gertie sniffed and said, Okay, boss, okay, keep calm. This fellow's a poorie. He's not going on display. The boss looked at the number on the table and consulted the list he was carrying, saying, Oh, him, yes. They can't go above $300. We'll just box them up and send them off. What are we going to do about clothes? The girl looked to where the naked body was beside her and asked, What's wrong with the clothes he had on when he came in? The boss said, They were hardly good enough to put in the garbage can. Anyway, they've shrunk so much after being washed, they aren't going to go on now. Gertie said, Well, how about those old curtains we took down? We decided they were too faded to put up again. Couldn't we wrap them in one of those? The boss glowered at her and replied, They're worth $10. Who's going to pay $10 for it? I think the best thing to do is put some shavings in the casket, dump him on that, put some more shavings on top. That's good enough. Nobody's going to see him anyhow. Do that. He stamped off, and Gertie resumed her lunch. Over it all hovered Molly Grubber in his astral form, unseen, unheard, but seeing and hearing all. He was sickened at the way his body was being treated, but some strange power held him there. He could not move. He could not shift from the spot at all. He watched everything going on, watch some bodies being clothed in absolutely wonderful dresses, the women and men being done up in what seemed to be evening dress or formals, while he thought, would be lucky enough to get a handful or two of shavings. "What you reading, Bert?" somebody called out. A young man with a paperback book in one hand and a hamburger in the other looked up suddenly and waved the book at the questioner. "I believe," he answered. "It's a darn good book, I'm telling you. It's by that fellow Rampa who lives in the city. I've read all his books, and one thing's stuck in my mind ever since. It's that you've got to believe something, because if you don't believe in anything, you're stuck good and fast in the wilderness. Look at that fellow there." He gestured towards the body of old Molly Grubber, lying cold, still and naked, on the table. "That fellow is a complete atheist. Wonder what he's doing now. Can't be in heaven, because he didn't believe in it. Can't be in hell, because he didn't believe in that either. Must be stuck between worlds. This fellow Rampa always says that you don't have to believe what he says, but believe in something, or at least keep an open mind, because if you don't keep an open mind, then helpers, or whatever they're called on the other side, can't keep in touch with you, can't help you. And somewhere in one of his books he says that when you pass over, you get stuck in nothingness." He laughed and then went on. "He also says that when people get to the stage just out of the body, they see what they expect to see. That must be a sight to see all the angels fluttering about." A man moved across and looked at the cover on the book. "Funny looking guy, ain't he? Wonder what that picture's meant to be." "I don't know," said the book's owner. "That's one of the things about these books. You get covers and blow me away, you never know what that cover means. Never mind, it's the words inside that I buy 'em for." Old Molly Grubber hovered closer. Through no effort of his own, he seemed to be guided to places. As the men were talking about the book, he was sent to hover right over them, and it stuck in his mind. If you don't believe in a thing, then as far as you're concerned, it doesn't exist, and then what are you going to do? The lunch hour wore on. Some people were reading with books propped up against corpses, and Gertie had her lunch spread out on old Molly Grubber's body, just as though he were a spare table for her convenience. At last the bell went and lunch break was over. The people cleared up the remnants of their food, balled up the paper, put it in the garbage bin. Gertie picked up a brush and brushed the crumbs off Molly Grubber's body. He looked down in disgust at her uncaring, unfeeling actions. "Hey, you guys there, get that body ready immediately. Toss some shavings in that shell number 49, and toss that fellow in on top of the shavings. Then put some more shavings on top. He shouldn't leak any, but we've got to make sure that everything is mopped up." The boss man again. He danced into the big room with a sheaf of papers in his hand, and then he said, "They want the funeral to be at 2:30 this afternoon, which is rushing it a bit. I must go and get changed." He turned tail and fled. Gertie and one of the men rolled Molly Grubber's body onto one side and passed loops beneath him, and then moved him to the other side so they could get at the loops. Little hooks were pulled up to engage in eyelets, and then the body was swung up on what seemed to be a little railway running on rods. They pushed Molly Grubber's body to the side of the room where what they called a shell, which was numbered 49 in chalk, was standing ready with the lid off. The man assistant went to a big bin and took out a lot of sawdust, which he poured liberally into the casket until there was about 6 inches of sawdust. Then Molly Grubber's body was lowered into the casket. The girl said, "There, I think he should be all right. I don't think he'll leak any. I've got him tied off all right down there, and of course I've got him plugged everywhere else, too. I don't think he'll leak, but let's put in more sawdust instead of shavings. The old man won't know." So they got another load of sawdust and poured it onto the body until Molly Grubber was covered. Then, together, they lifted up the lid and put it on with a slam. The man reached for a pneumatically powered screwdriver and turned down the screws as the woman put them in the holes with her fingers. She reached out and picked up a damp rag, then carefully wiped off the number in chalk. The casket, or shell, was hoisted up from the trestles and moved sideways onto a wheeled trolley. A purple pall was placed over it, and the whole affair was wheeled out of the workroom into the showroom and display rooms. There came shouting, and the boss, now done up as a conventional funeral director in very formal clothing, black jacket, silk hat, striped trousers, moved onto the scene. "Push him out of there. Get him. Move on, will you?" he shouted. "The hearse is out there. The door's open. Everyone's waiting. Get him. Move on." Gertie and the male assistant got a move on and pushed a casket along to a ramp where there was a special loading device. It consisted of a lot of rollers in a frame extending from the ramp right on to the back of the hearse. They put the casket on the rollers and easily pushed it straight into the hearse. The driver got out of his seat and said, "Okie dokie, okay, off we go." The director got in beside him, and slowly the garage doors were rolled up and the hearse moved out. There was only one car waiting outside, a car with Molly Grubber's 4 associates in it. They were done up in their best Sunday clothes, probably clothes which had been redeemed, especially from the pawnbroker. Some of these men had the bright idea that when they were not using their Sunday clothes, they would leave them with the pawnbroker, because then they would have money to spend until the end of the week when they were paid. And in addition, the pawnbroker always cleaned the clothes and had them neatly pressed before putting them in the hold room. Poor Molly Grubber seemed to be attached to his body by invisible cords. As the casket was being pushed along, poor old Molly Grubber, in his astral form, was being dragged along, and he had no say whatsoever in the matter at all. Instead, he was kept about 10 feet above the body, and he found himself plowing invisibly through walls, floors, and ceilings, and then at last he was moved out into the hearse, and the hearse moved out into the open. The funeral director leaned out of the hearse and said to the 4 men, "Okay, all right then, let's go." The hearse moved out of the funeral home parking lot, and the 4 mourners in the car followed on behind. They had their headlights on to show that this was a funeral, and on the side of the following car there was a little triangular flag fixed from the top of the window reading "Funeral." That meant that it could go across traffic lights, and the police would not do a thing about it. They moved on through the busy streets, past children playing in schoolyards, and came to the long climb up to the cemetery. There, the funeral director stopped, got out, and went to the car following. "Keep close to us," he said, "because at the next intersection there's always somebody trying to cut in between, and we don't want to delay things too long, and you may lose the way. We have to take third on the right and first on the left, okay?" The man driving the other car nodded, so the funeral director went back to the hearse. They took off again, with the following car really tailgating. Soon they reached the gates of the cemetery. The hearse and the following car moved in and up a driveway. At the top and off to the side, there was a newly dug grave with a frame over it and the pulleys on the side. The hearse moved up, turned, and backed. Two men waiting by the graveside moved toward the hearse. The driver and the funeral director got out, and the four of them opened the back of the hearse, pulling out the coffin. They turned it and moved it to the grave. The four mourners followed. "This man was an atheist," said the funeral director, "and so there will be no service. That will save you certain expense, and we will just lower him and cover him up." The other men nodded, and the coffin was eased over the top of the rollers, and special web straps were put under. Then, slowly, the coffin was lowered into the ground. The four men moved up to the open grave as one, looked down, and they were quite upset, quite sad. One said, "Poor old Molly Grubber, nobody in the world to care about him." Another one said, "Well, I hope he's got somebody where he's going or where he's gone." With that, they went back to their car, backed it, turned, and slowly drove off out of the cemetery. The two men beside the funeral director tipped aboard, and a whole load of earth fell into the casket with a hollow, sickening sound. The director said, "Oh, well, cover him up, that's that," and moved to the hearse. The driver got in, and they drove off. Molly Grubber hovered above, powerless to do anything, powerless to move, and he looked down and he thought, "So this is the end of life. What now? Where do I go from here? I've always believed there was nothing after death, but I'm dead, and there's my body, and I'm here. So what am I, and where am I?" With that, there seemed to be a loud thrumming sound, like the sound of the wind through telephone lines on a high hillside, and Molly Grubber found himself speeding into nothingness. There was nothing before him, nothing behind him, nothing at either side, neither at the front or back, and he sped on unto nothingness. Silence. Silence, nothing but silence, not a sound. He listened very, very carefully, but there was no sound of a heartbeat, no sound of breathing. He held his breath, or thought he did, and then it came to him with a shock that his heart was not beating, and his lungs were not working either. From force of habit, he put his hands out to feel his chest. There was a distinct impression that he had put his hands out, a very distinct impression that everything was working, but there was nothing there, nothing. The silence grew oppressive. He shifted uneasily, but did he? He was not sure of anything anymore. He tried moving a leg. Tentatively, he tried to twiddle a toe, but no, nothing. No sensation of feeling, no sensation of movement, no sensation that anything was. He lay back, or thought he did, and tried to compose himself, tried to compose his thoughts. How do you think, in the midst of nothingness, when you have the impression yourself that you are nothing, that you do not even exist, but then you must exist? That is what he thought, because if he had not been existing, well, he couldn't think. He thought of the casket being lowered down into the hard, hard earth, the earth dried out with days and days of dryness, with no rain, with never a cloud in the sky. He thought. As he thought, there was a sudden sensation of motion. He looked, he would have said, over the side, with astonishment, and found that he was over his grave. But how could that be, when a second ago, what was time? Time, how could he measure time here? By habit, he tried to look down at his wrist, but no, there was no watch there. There was no arm there, either. There was nothingness. As he looked down, all he saw was the grave. He saw, with considerable astonishment and fright, that there was long grass on his grave. How long does grass take to grow? There was every evidence that he could have been buried well over a month ago. The grass could not have grown so quickly, could not have grown in any lesser time than a month or 6 weeks. And then he found his vision slipping beneath the grass, beneath the earth, and he saw the earthworms burrowing and moving. He saw little beetles bustling about. His sight penetrated further, and he saw the wood of the coffin. Further, he saw below the lid of the coffin, saw the moldering, decaying mass within. Instantly he recoiled and sprang up with a soundless shriek of terror, or that was the sensation that he had. He found himself quivering, absolutely shaking in every limb, but then he recalled that he had no limbs. He had no body there, so far as he could tell. He gazed about him, but still there was nothing to see, no light, no dark, only the void of complete emptiness, where even light could not exist. The sensation was terrible, shocking. But then, how did he feel a sensation if he had no body? He lay there, or should it be existed there, trying to work out what was. Suddenly, a vagrant thought came creeping across his consciousness. I believe, the thought came. Rampa, the thought came. What was it those fellows had been talking about the last time he saw them up at the sanitation depot? A number of street cleaners were there, a number of garbage truck drivers too, and they were talking about life and death and all the rest of it, a talk which had been generated by Molly Grubber showing a book by Lobsang Rampa. One of the men had said, "Well, I don't know what to believe, never did know what to believe. My religion don't help me any, doesn't give us any answers, just says you must have faith. How can you have faith when there's never any proof of anything? Any of you fellows ever had a prayer answered?" he had asked. He looked about and saw the negative shakes of his colleagues' heads. One said, "No, I never did. Never known anyone either who got a prayer answered. When I was a little un, I got taught the Bible, and a thing that stuck in my mind then was all the old fellows, great prophets and saints and whatnot. They used to pray their fool heads off, but they didn't get any answers. Nothing good ever happened. I mind reading one day about the crucifixion. It said in the good book that Christ uttered words on the cross, 'Lord, Lord, why hast thou forsaken me?' But he got no answer." There was an uneasy silence among the men as they looked down and shuffled their feet in discomfort, and with unaccustomed minds they tried to think of the future. What was there after death? Anything? Do bodies just return to the earth as a putrefying mass and then as sterile bones crumbling into dust? There must be something more than this, they thought. There was a definite purpose to life and a definite purpose to death. Some of them looked a bit guiltily at their fellows as they recalled strange circumstances, peculiar happenings, and events which could not be explained by anything within their consciousness. One fellow said, "Well, that author you've been telling us about who lives downtown, well, my missus has been reading his books, and she's been going on to me something terrible. She said, 'Jake, Jake, if you don't believe anything, you've got nothing to hang on to when you're dead.' She said, 'If you believe that there is an afterlife, then you will experience an afterlife. It's as simple as that. You've got to believe that there is an afterlife. Otherwise, you'll float like a bubble on the wind, just drifting about, almost without existence. You've got to believe. You've got to keep an open mind so you can be ready to believe if you have something to stimulate your interest when you pass over.'" There had been a long silence after that utterance. The men had looked embarrassed and fidgeted uncomfortably, wondering how they could get away without appearing to run away. Molly Grubber thought of it all as he lay there, or stood there, or sat there, he didn't know which, in his nothingness, being just a disembodied thought so far as he could tell. But then, perhaps that author was right. Perhaps people had persecuted him and picked on him and given him unfavorable publicity because they did not know, because they were wrong. Perhaps that author was right. Now, what was it he was teaching? Molly Grubber strained and strained to recall the fleeting thought which had barely touched the rippling surface of his consciousness, and then it came to him. "You must believe in something. If you are a Catholic, then you believe in a form of heaven peopled with saints and angels. If you're a Jew, you believe in a different form. If you're a follower of Islam, then you have a different form again of heaven. But you must believe in something. You must keep an open mind so that even if you do not actually believe now, you still have openness in your mind so that you can be convinced. Otherwise, you will float idly between worlds, between planes, floating as a drifting thought, as tenuous as a thought." Molly Grubber thought and thought about it. He thought how, throughout his life, he had denied the existence of a God, denied the existence of a religion, thinking that all priests were money-grabbing Shylocks out to con the public with a lot of fairy tales. He thought about it. He tried to picture the old author whom he had once seen close up. He focused on his rendering of the author's face, and to his terror, it seemed that the author's face was right in front of him, speaking, talking to him. "You must believe. Unless you believe in something, you're just a drifting shadow, without power, without motivation, and without anchor. You must believe. You must keep your mind open. You must be ready to receive help, so that you may be removed from the void, from the sterile emptiness, and moved on to another plane of existence." Again, Molly Grubber thought, "I wonder who's using my old barrow now." And like a flash, he saw again the streets of Calgary, saw a young fellow this time pushing along his barrow, sweeping the streets, stopping every so often to have a smoke, and then he saw the old author, and he quivered with fright as he looked down and found the old author was looking up, with a sort of half-smile on his lips. And then the lips formed words, "Believe something. Believe. Open your mind. There are people ready to help you." Molly Grubber looked again and felt a surge of rage at the man who was using his old barrow. It was a dirty old barrow now, with dirt ingrained in the hinges of the lids and around the handles. The broom was worn too, not even worn evenly, but worn unevenly at an angle, and that, to him, betrayed that the present user was not a man with pride in his job. He felt a surge of rage, and with that came a great speed, frightening, mind-numbing speed. And yet it was also strange. How could he feel speed when there was no feeling of motion? How could he have speed without the wind on his face? And then he shuddered with terror. Did he have a face? Was he in a place where there was wind? He did not know. Molly Grubber just was. There was no feeling of time, hardly a feeling of being. He just was. His mind ticked over, just idle thoughts creeping across the screen of his mental vision. Then again he pictured the old author, and almost heard the words which had not been uttered. "You must believe in something." With that, Molly Grubber had a picture of his childhood, the poor, poor conditions under which he had lived. He remembered a picture in a Bible and a sentence, "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He leadeth me." He leadeth me. The thought beat an endless refrain in Molly Grubber's mind, or his consciousness, or whatever was left to him now, and he thought, "I wish he'd lead me. I wish somebody would lead me." With his thought, he felt something. He could not tell what it was. He had a sensation that people were near. It reminded him of when he'd been sleeping in a doss house, and whenever any other person came by in that big room, he would be aware of it, not to the point of waking up, but to the point of being on guard in case they tried to steal the watch beneath his pillow or the thin wallet tucked in the small of his back. He uttered a thought, "Help me, help me." And then he seemed to feel that he had feet. There was a strange tipping sensation. And yes, he had feet. bare feet, and with a sickening sensation of terror, he found that his feet were on something sticky. Tar, maybe, he thought. He recalled the time when he was young, and he had rushed out of the house barefooted, and he had walked straight into where the city roadmen had been tarring the highway. He remembered the fright, the terror. He was very young, the thought that he was stuck on the road and he would never get away again. It was like that now. He was stuck. Stuck in tar. And then, he thought, that tar was creeping up along his body. Yes, he could feel a body now. He had arms, hands, and fingers, but he could not move them because they were stuck in tar. Or if it was not tar, it was something sticky, something that inhibited movement. And about him, he could swear there were people, and the people were watching him. He felt a surge of rage, red, red rage, almost a killing rage, and he sent out the thought, "Okay, you guys, what are you gaping at me for? Why don't you come and give me a hand? Can't you see I'm stuck, eh?" The thought came back clear and loud, almost like some of the things he'd seen on the television sets, which he had watched in the windows of dealers. "You must believe. You must believe. You must open your mind before we can help you, for you are repelling us with every thought. Believe. We are here, ready to help you. Believe." He snorted and tried to run after the people who were staring at him, for he was sure they were staring. But he found that his movements were just floundering. He was stuck in tar. Movements were almost imperceptible. He suddenly thought, "Oh my God, what's happened?" And with the thought of, "Oh my God," he had seen a light in the darkness, like the sunlight creeping over the horizon at the earliest part of the morning. He looked in awe, and then again experimentally mumbled, "God, God, help me." To his delight and surprise, the light brightened, and he thought that he saw a figure standing on the skyline beckoning to him. But no, Molly Grubber was not ready yet. He just mumbled to himself, "A strange cloud, I guess that's what it'll be. Nobody wants to help me." So the light darkened, and the brightness on the skyline vanished, and Molly Grubber sank more deeply into the tar, or whatever it was. Time passed. Endless time passed. There was no indication of how much time passed, but the entity that had been Molly Grubber just rested somewhere, immersed in the darkness of disbelief. And around him there were those who would help him if only he would open his mind to belief. Open his mind so that the helpers could do their task and lead him forward to the light, to whatever form of life or existence there was. He was in considerable turmoil, worse because he could not feel arms, legs, or anything else, and it was, well, disturbing, to say the least. For some reason, he could not get that old author out of his mind. It was really sticking there and prodding at him. There was something bubbling beneath his consciousness. At last, he got it. A few months before, he had seen the old author in the electrically propelled wheelchair. He'd been tootling around in the new park which had been made, and there was a man with him. Molly Grubber, as was his wont, had stopped to listen to the two conversing. There was something the author was saying. "You know, the Christian Bible sheds a lot of light on the matter of life after death, and it always strikes me as most remarkable that Christians, Catholics in particular, believe in saints, angels, devils, and so on, and yet, for some extraordinary reason, they still seem to doubt life after death. So how are they going to explain Ecclesiastes 12, 5-7, which actually says, because man goes to his eternal home and the mourners go about the streets, before the silver cord is snapped or the golden bowl is broken, or the pitcher is broken at the fountain or the wheel broken at the cistern, the dust returns to the earth as it was, and the spirit returns to God who gave it." "Well," the old author had said to the other man, "you know what that means, don't you? It means that of the body of a person, one part returns to the dust from which it was alleged to have been made, and the other portion returns to God or to life beyond this." Now that's the Christian Bible. They acknowledge life after death, but the Christians apparently do not. But then, there are a lot of things Christians don't believe in. They'll find out, though, when they get to the other side. Molly Grubber really jumped, or rather he felt as if he had jumped. How can you jump if you have no body? The words seemed as though they had been uttered just behind him. Somehow he managed to turn around his consciousness, but there was nothing behind him. So he mused on the problem for a time, thinking perhaps he had been lost, perhaps he had allowed his early life to distort his thinking. Perhaps there was something in the life after the earth life. There must be, he concluded, because he had seen his body dying, he had seen his body dead, and he had shuddered and would have been sick if he could have seen his body decaying, with the skeleton bones showing through the rotting flesh. "Yes," he muttered to himself, if one can mutter without a voice, "there must be something in life after death. He must have been misled all these years. Maybe the bitterness he had generated through hardship in his early life had distorted his values. Yes, there must be some sort of life because he was still alive, or he supposed he was. And if he was not alive, how was he thinking these things? Yes, he must be having some sort of a life." As that thought came to him, he felt a most peculiar thing happening. He seemed to be prickling all over. Prickling to what would have been the outline of a body. He felt that he had arms and legs and hands and feet, and he twisted a bit and he could sense them. And then, oh, glory be to goodness, the light was growing in the nothingness, in the utter void in which he had been existing. Light was beginning to penetrate. It was a rosy hue, very faint at first, but growing stronger. And then, with a suddenness which almost made him sick, he tilted and seemed to be falling on his feet. After a short while, he landed on something sticky, something gooey, and about him he could see a black fog interspersed with rays of pinkish light. He tried to move and found that while motion was not entirely inhibited, it was difficult. He seemed to be in some viscid material which slowed him up, which made him move in slow motion. And there he was, floundering about, lifting first one foot and then the other. He thought to himself that he was like one of those weird monsters sometimes portrayed on the covers of gaudy science fiction books. He shouted aloud, "Oh, God, if there is a God, help me!" No sooner were the words uttered than he felt a change in his circumstances. The sticky goo disappeared. The material around him became thinner, and he could faintly discern figures moving about. It was a strange, strange sensation. He likened it to being a plastic bag, the plastic being smoke-colored. He was there, trying to peer out through the hazy plastic, and getting nowhere. He stood there, shielding his eyes with his hands, and trying to force himself to see whatever there was to see. He got an impression, more than vision, of people stretching out their hands to reach him, but not being able to touch him. There seemed to be some sort of barrier, some invisible, transparent wall. "Oh, goodness," he thought, "if only this unmentionable color would go away, if only I could tear down this wall, or paper, or plastic, or whatever it is. I can't see what these people are. They may be wanting to help me. They may be wanting to kill me. But how can they do that when I'm already dead? Or am I dead?" He shuddered and shuddered again as a sudden thought came to him. "Am I in the hospital?" he said to himself. "Am I having nightmares after seeing that priest? Maybe I'm alive back on Earth and this is all a hideous nightmare. Oh, I wish I knew." Faintly, faintly, as though from a great distance, a voice came to him, so faint, so unclear, that he had to strain and strain to resolve what was being said. "Believe, believe, believe in life hereafter. Believe, only believe, and we can set you free. Pray to God. There is a God. It doesn't matter what you call him. It doesn't matter what form of religion. Every religion has a God. Believe. Call unto your own God for help. We are waiting, waiting." Molly Grubber stood still. No more did his feet continue their ceaseless tramping, trying to break through the veil that surrounded him. He stood quietly. He thought of the old author, he thought of the priests, and he rejected the priests out of hand as being nothing but fakes, looking for an easy way to get a living by preying on the superstitions of others. He thought back to his early days, thought of the Bible, and then he prayed to God for enlightenment. "Oh, mighty God, whatever form you adopt, help me. I am stuck. I am lost. I have my being, but I have no being. Help me and let others help me." With that, and with a believing heart, he felt a sudden shock, as if he had touched two bare wires on an electric light standard. For a moment, he reeled as the veil tore. End of chapter 4.